You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an intelligence report points toward one of Saudi Arabia's top officials in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. We'll find out what that means for U.S. relations with the Middle Eastern country. Now, President Biden is making a major push to make vaccines available for all teachers by the end of the month and to get schools open as soon as possible. Teachers and daycare providers are now eligible to be vaccinated in Wisconsin. The 47,000 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine the state's set to receive next week are supposed to help that effort. We're talking now about the push to reopen schools and the challenge of getting teachers across the country vaccinated. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Teachers, if you've been teaching remotely, what do you need to feel ready for in-person school again? If you've already been teaching in person, what kind of precautions are in place? How's it going for you? Have you been able to get vaccinated or at least get an appointment? And parents, what do you think? Do you want in-person schooling as soon as possible? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Aaron Richards is a national education reporter for USA Today, based in Milwaukee. Aaron, welcome back to the show.
Hi there.
Well, I mentioned, you know, many schools are working to reopen. A lot of schools are already doing in person. What do we know about how much or how many of our kids are actually going to the old-fashioned school building these days?
Sure. So across the country, we've still got under half of public school students who are getting a traditional in-person instruction experience. So there's a company called Burbio. They've been tracking school reopening calendars throughout the pandemic. We've got about 44% of public school kids across the country that are getting that traditional, what looked like learning before the pandemic. Now, because we've got about another 28% of kids or so who are getting some in-person learning, that means like maybe a couple days a week you're in class and then the rest of the days you're learning from home. That means that overall, we've got about, if you want to say, are you getting into a classroom building at all? It's about 72% of kids nationwide in public schools. So then that other percentage, about one in four kids, or about a quarter of the U.S. public school population, is at home all the time, still learning remotely. That includes districts like Milwaukee and Madison, where almost everybody is still 100% remote. There might be a couple of special cases, kids with particular special needs, maybe getting some in-person help. But for the most part, that the larger urban districts where rates of transmission have been high are still in many cases sort of on the bubble of reopening.
And now here we've got a new presidential administration, now a new education secretary. They're trying, they say, to bump up the timeline of vaccinations. What are we hearing now from the new White House?
Well, President Biden has pushed for the reopening of schools 5 days a week. The goal has shifted a little bit. First, it was all students. Now it's mostly focused on K-8 students. But Biden has recommitted to the idea that as much as possible, we want K-8 students in school 5 days a week. Now, the CDC has also recommended that this can happen even without staff all being vaccinated. There's a number of studies that show that in-school transmission is pretty low and can be kept that way, even if there is some level of spread in the community. But some of those studies were based on smaller school districts or places where it was easier to spread out. For example, rural Wisconsin was the basis for one of the main CDC studies that shows how important mitigation tactics are to keeping schools open, even without people being vaccinated. So on the and then on the other hand, you've also got a new education secretary who has just been confirmed, and he comes from a state, Connecticut, where the push was really to keep as many schools open as possible. It was by no means a happenstance that the new education secretary was in a school building this week in Connecticut to kind of wave the flag for in-person learning with, you know, plexiglass and masks and some level of physical distancing. So the message is really, let's get kids back in school as quickly as we can. But the slow vaccine rollout and some pushback from teachers and teachers unions is still making that a challenge for some districts to actually achieve, you know, next week.
Let's look at some urban school districts, maybe with old school buildings already kind of crowded. I mean, are there just logistical setups in certain districts in some parts of the country that make this a harder sell and harder to pull off safely?
That has been the argument from many teachers' unions. It's not that, particularly in larger cities, Pittsburgh, San Francisco, Milwaukee to a degree, that these are old buildings. They don't have not every classroom has been updated with, a brand new HVAC system. That there isn't enough money to do that quickly or before we get kids in class. And so the worry has been not that we don't know what to do. It's that we don't trust our district administration to get us there, right? And we're fearful for our safety. And so that's why we'd rather wait until we're fully vaccinated. So there are some issues with older buildings. To some degree, though, we have seen some large urban districts that have stayed open almost the whole time or from the beginning of the year. Places like Miami, Providence, Rhode Island have at least had that option for in-person learning, even if many, many families are choosing to learn remotely.
We're talking to Aaron Richards, national education reporter for USA Today, talking about the latest on school reopenings and vaccination for teachers and school staff. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see schools open up as much as possible, as fast as possible? If you're a teacher, do you have a vaccine appointment in hand? Do you want to wait to go back to school until you have at least a dose of vaccine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Aaron, let's talk about that drive now. The Biden administration saying we're going to have vaccines available at least for teachers by the end of this month. Can you talk about their drive to get teachers vaccinated, even if they're saying don't wait to open schools on these vaccinations?
Right. So one action we saw this week that was different from the previous administration was really directing states to move teachers up in the priority list. Now, about 2/3 of states had already given educators, childcare workers, often K-12 teachers, some level of priority over other folks. And honestly, the president's powers on this are pretty limited. There's a bigger role for states and down to education matters, local districts, to determine how things roll in their local communities. The president is really using his bully pulpit to say, please move your teachers up. And many states have indeed responded by trying to reprioritize teachers if they weren't already up there. So that's why you see places like, even here in Wisconsin, there's some degree of optimism that many more teachers will have at least their first dose of the vaccine by the middle of this month. And I think that's really encouraging, especially to educators that didn't feel like they were, potentially going to get a shot soon enough. So there's certainly, by speeding up the federal vaccine rollout as much as possible to trying to pave the way for this new Johnson & Johnson vaccine to get out, there's going to be more avenues for educators to get the shot that many of them would like to have before they go back to a classroom.
And then the question has come up, and you wrote about this, Aaron, can schools mandate that teachers and other school staff have to be vaccinated? What has been the buzz on that?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question because private employers actually can require their employees to get a shot, to get immunizations. We probably won't see districts do that for some time, if ever, for a couple reasons. Districts are, a little reluctant to do that for something so new, first of all. And if they did make that a condition of employment, especially in a place where a teachers union is stronger, teachers unions are stronger in some cities and states than others, in a strong union, it would almost inevitably spark a grievance and there could be litigation and it could get expensive. And so it's just not worth it at this point, right? And the other thing is supply and demand. There's a lot more people out there that want a shot that can't even get it at the moment. So for a district to take the step to require it at this point, just probably not, good policy or practice. But once the vaccine gets full FDA approval, that's another, that's some other gray area there. The shots that many districts and employers do require now have full, tried and true FDA approval for continued use. So once that happens, it might be another debate. But at the moment, I don't think you're going to see that anytime soon.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Sarah is with us in Kenosha. Sarah, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Sarah?
Well, I was started a couple of days ago looking to see where I can get a vaccine because I'm an educator, and I called my doctor and I called a bunch of other places, but I'm having a hard time finding where to get one, mostly because I own a small company. I give technology lessons to senior citizens, and I don't work for a district, so nobody's going to call me. I was wondering if you could tell me or give me any tips.
Sarah, thanks for the call. I mean, this is a question a lot of people have in vaccine-eligible categories, Aaron, but there aren't enough vaccines yet. Even if people want them and maybe are eligible, it may be tough to find.
Right. I mean, even for Milwaukee, as they try to speed up their vaccination schedule, I noticed that the one nuance there is that you need to either live in Milwaukee or work in Milwaukee. Well, what does that mean for somebody who is just outside the city? Like, it seems like, again, the vaccine rollout has been so fractured that it's a little hard to know sometimes where you can go to get it and who is eligible, right? There are some people that are volunteers for districts that have passed a background check, that are on the rolls as a, you know, as a school district volunteer. Does that qualify you as somebody who could potentially get the vaccine, especially if you are working with anybody in person? Those are questions that just haven't been answered very, that just don't have a lot of answers yet from what I've seen. So I'm sorry I can't answer Sarah's question very well, because I think a lot of people are asking those same questions, especially if they're not directly connected to an individual school district.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Aaron Richards, national education reporter for USA Today, about efforts to get more schools open for in-person education and the vaccine plans for teachers and school staff. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is hybrid schooling a good option right now, do you think? Has that worked in your school district? What do you want to know about how school reopenings are going across the country? Love to hear from parents, teachers, and school staff. Maybe if you're a student yourself, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with USA Today education reporter Aaron Richards. School districts around the country are grappling with how to safely reopen as President Biden pushes to get teachers access to vaccines by the end of the month. You can join in with your thoughts and experiences at schools, working in them, sending kids to them, being a kid at them, or working away from them. 800-642-1234. Are you hankering to get back to in-person education? Are you worried about it right now? 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Andrew is with us in Appleton. Andrew, hello.
Hi, I just want to make a quick comment that I'm an educator in the Appleton area, and I found it very easy to find a vaccine through Walgreens. Their website was easy to use, and I passed that along to a lot of my other fellow educators, and we all got vaccine through Walgreens, and this was before the rollout of our scheduled school district. Our school district had us on the 12th, but we wanted to get it sooner, so we all got in.
All right, and are you working in the schools right now, Andrew, or remote, or a little of both?
I've been working in the schools since day one. I'm actually in Freedom, which is kind of just north of Appleton, the small school district, but we've been in full attendance since day one.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Andrew. Aaron, some teachers are finding vaccines, but like so many things with the whole pandemic and with education during it, it's hit or miss, and it depends on where you are.
Yeah, we found that early in the pandemic, there were some teachers who were, or sorry, not early in the vaccine rollout, there were some teachers who were even crossing state lines because they could find that if they were in a nearby state that had teachers prioritized and they were in one that wasn't, that they, I think this was like Georgia to Alabama or Alabama to Georgia. They were like literally driving a couple of hours to go do exactly what the caller Andrew had done. I'm also curious, I didn't get a chance to ask him, but I wonder if he had to show a school ID or if Walgreens just was taking appointments and had, you know, it available. Because there's all kinds of Facebook groups now, too, where people are connecting to try to say, you know, where did you get a shot or how did you do it or what did you need to show?
Oh, Andrew, are you still there? Can we ask you that?
Yeah, sure. I'm still on. No, I didn't have to show any ID. A number of my fellow teachers, they did ask what's your employment, and they just trusted that we were educators. And, we had to show a driver's license and everything, but there is a questionnaire online that you had to fill out that said you are an essential frontline worker, but that's about it.
All right, Andrew, thanks a lot. Glad you could answer that question for us. So, yeah, you don't need to show your teacher ID card, I guess, Aaron.
Yeah, no, it's just interesting because, you know, we've also written at USA Today stories about people sort of, if not officially jumping the line, just kind of going and seeking it out when maybe only, you know, elders, the elderly or sick were prioritized in their state. But to some degree, you know, the rollout has been so fractured that you can't always blame people for just trying to do what they can do to make themselves safe, especially if they're teaching around or, you know, around a lot of people on a day-to-day basis for work.
And thanks for that call. Before we go back to our callers, when you say the rollout has been fractured, are you talking just here in Wisconsin, or is this something that schools and teachers are dealing with all over the country?
Oh, this is all over. I mean, we've seen educators desperate for the vaccine in all kinds of cities and states, and it, whether they could get it right away often came down to location and luck.
Go back to our callers now. Jennifer is with us in Minocqua. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just going to agree with the previous caller. It is a luck kind of situation.
That's okay.
I'm fortunate enough to get the vaccine because I'm in a program that goes into a hospital. However, it's weird to hear myself.
Yeah, I'll jump in, Jennifer. It's easier if you have the radio off. But luck for Jennifer. And I want to bring in another teacher perspective or staff perspective. Marcus is with us in Adams. Marcus, hi.
Yes, hi. I was on my way home from actually getting my first dose of the vaccine today after school. We've been in person all year, which, you know, to me, it's been great with the students being able to do that. But the fracturedness that you guys are talking about seems to show up because my spouse works in another district in central Wisconsin, and they have their date set up for like 2 weeks from now. But, you know, I think it also gives us this reassuring idea like, hey, you get this vaccine. So it gives us some comfort for being in person. Obviously, we have two doses of this vaccine. And the first dose, I'm an hour and no symptoms or anything. So I'm very excited to get it. Glad.
And Marcus, I meant to ask some of the teachers have called in. Did in-person look different this year? Like what kind of stuff did you do differently to take account of COVID, even though you're still in the school?
Oh, big time. So in person at our district, I teach at Adams Friendship. We've done smaller class sizes. We've limited the number of transitions during the day. Mm-hmm. We've gone on like a 6-week rotation versus we're in trimesters usually, which is 12 weeks. So we'll split those classes up to 6 weeks. So smaller class sizes. We also do a number of putting spacers in between tables and desks and, you know, mandatory mask wearing and, you know, having hand sanitizer and teaching, you know, good hand washing skills. So that's been big.
Marcus, thanks for the call. And I'm glad Marcus could tell us about that, Aaron, because even when schools have been in from day one, it hasn't been business as usual, as we just heard from Marcus there.
No, I mean, every district that I've talked to across the country that's successfully holding class with minimal transmission of the virus has faithfully followed most of this, if not all of the protocol, you know, masking, some level of distancing, podding, you know, pods of students for some. There have been some places that have just been lucky. They've been maybe a little more lax, but there hasn't been as much transmission. But I certainly think it makes more people feel safer. And just based on what we know about the science of how this thing spreads. I'm also curious, like, back to the vaccine question, I'm also curious how much districts themselves are helping their teachers get the vaccine, or how much of it is just, like the previous caller, the local Walgreens has enough doses available and you can sign up and they ask you about your work and off you go. Like, I'm fascinated by how some counties and school districts seem to be working together and other teachers just seem to be finding it on their own and knowing what line of work they're in or just pursuing it individually.
Thanks again for that call, Marcus. Aaron, in our last minute or so, I want to come back to a topic we've talked about a bunch before. It seems like there's a general consensus that safety aside, in-person education for most students in most places is going to be better than trying to do it online. Is that about right?
Well, that's a difficult blanket statement because there are going to be parents out there that have seen their kids really doing pretty well online. But what we know, both from research and from more, you know, sort of shorter term anecdotes this year, is that kids who were struggling before the pandemic with maybe time management or stressful family circumstances, cramped quarters, not the best technology or reliable internet, those are the kids that are struggling the most with online learning. And there's a limited amount schools can do to help them if they can't, you know, be in person with them all day long. So those are the kids that we're most concerned about. And that's why even just having the option of 5-day a week instruction is so critical for a lot of people, or that's why it's seen as so critical, because we know that the kids who are struggling the most are also likely to be the ones that are not logging on, that are missing class, that aren't staying logged in the whole time. And so they're just getting less attention from teachers, and therefore they're making less progress. And that puts them at risk for all the things we worry about, right? Falling behind, not graduating, not going to college or post-secondary training, and not getting a job and being able to support yourself. So it's all a cascading effect. And that's why there's so much focus this year on trying to help those kids get in-person learning if they've really fallen off track.
And Aaron, in just our last 30 seconds or so, what are you watching for next with the reopening effort?
A couple of things. So I'm looking for this next round of bigger, you know, large urban districts, what going back looks like for them. We're already starting to see, you know, places like Milwaukee and Madison announce plans for April. I mean, what does it look like to only get maybe 6 weeks of education in person before the end of the year? And then secondly, what does summer look like? What states and districts are going to step forward with pretty robust summer programming, summer learning? Is it going to be in person? Is it going to be remote? Is it going to be drill and kill? Is it still going to have some of the fun that summer school has usually included in the past? So those are things that that I'm looking at down the road.
Aaron, thanks for joining us again.
Of course. Always a pleasure.
Aaron Richards is a national education reporter at USA Today. Join us for a look at school reopening efforts. Coming up, the U.S., the Biden administration, and Saudi Arabia. We'll get the details. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, what does this week's new deal between two of the country's biggest pharmaceutical giants mean for you? And can we be sure the president can follow through on his promise to have enough vaccine supply for every U.S. adult by the end of May? Get answers to COVID-19 vaccine questions. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, newly declassified information shows why the CIA believes the Saudi crown prince ordered the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. According to a report released on Friday, the U.S. intelligence community said it would be, quote, highly unlikely, end quote, that Saudi officials would have carried out an operation like this without the crown prince giving the go-ahead. It's because he had absolute control of the kingdom's security and intelligence organizations. On Friday, President Biden said he will hold Saudi Arabia accountable for human rights abuses. Since then, the U.S. has imposed visa restrictions on dozens of Saudi individuals. So far, that doesn't appear to include Saudi crown prince Mohammed bin Salman. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the Biden administration do more to punish Saudi Arabia over the murder of the journalist? Do you think the president's doing some important pro-con math here, weighing and balancing the risks of offending Saudi Arabia? What kind of relationship do you want to see the U.S. have with the country going forward? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit. Saeed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me again, Rob.
Well, this report details why the CIA thinks that the Crown Prince had this role in Khashoggi's murder. In a lot of ways, though, this isn't a surprise. I think everybody pretty much thought that that role was there. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, since this rather terrible murder happened in Istanbul in October of 2018, all roads were pointing to Mohammed bin Salman, or as he's known colloquially, MBS. He wields simply too much power and authority within the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for it not to have past his desk, so to speak, or to put it in another way, if there were such things going on, there would have definitely been the ability for MBS to put a halt to it.
And let's talk about the role of the crown prince in Saudi Arabia. He's not the king. There is a king, but effectively he is and has been the face of Saudi Arabia around the world. Can you talk about his power in that country?
Well, crown princes have always wielded a tremendous level of both visibility as well as power within the kingdom. They oftentimes are the king behind the king. And we see that this has happened really since the early 1980s with, at that time, King Khalid, who was infirmed. We have to remember that a lot of the Saudi kings have ascended to the throne very late in life, all of them having been thus far, including the current King Salman, sons of the founder of Saudi Arabia, Abdulaziz bin Saud. So Khalid was in many ways eclipsed by his brother or half-brother Fahad, who then, when he became king, was quite active until he suffered from a rather debilitating stroke. His half-brother Abdullah then took over really the day-to-day operations until his death in 2015. And then we have the ascension of King Salman, who is in his mid-80s and not certainly getting any younger, and reports say that he does suffer from some form of dementia. MBS represents a real paradigm shift within Saudi Arabia. He will be the first king from the next generation, the grandchildren of the founder Abdulaziz Al Saud. He's only about 35 years old. He is very, very charming. And when he visited many Western capitals, he certainly charmed everybody, whether it was President Trump or going into London and Paris, as well as Berlin, speaking to people from all sectors, not just the political, but also financial and tech. He is adored, if not worshipped, in Saudi Arabia, particularly by young people that represent close to about 70% of the population being under the age of 30. So as a result of this, we find that MBS's position, both on the global scale until, of course, the Khashoggi murder, as well as domestically, is quite strong and quite prominent.
And there was a lot of speculation from columnists and politicians like, hey, this could be a guy who's going to bring Saudi Arabia into the 20th century, maybe not the 21st, but the 20th century, a modernizer, somebody we can work with, somebody who maybe is more in line with Western values. Now, this Khashoggi murder and other human rights issues, including Yemen, which we could talk about, people are rethinking that now, right?
Well, in a way, they are. When you say about bringing Saudi Arabia into the 20th century, MBS is rather ambitious. In fact, I think he's looking beyond the 21st century to bring Saudi Arabia into the 22nd century. Hmm. His Vision 2030 plan is one that is going to certainly remake the kingdom, one that is going beyond just some of the reforms that have come under his authority, including the liberalization of society. I think it's important to recognize that with Saudi Arabia, particularly over the last 3 years, there is a palpable shift, and particularly one that is being felt and internalized by the local population. The ability for women to now drive, the curbing of the otherwise dreaded religious police. They have certainly been curbed from their prosecutorial authority, being able to police the domestic social engagement of people. As a result of this, MBS is certainly looking forward to turning KSA, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, into something beyond some of his neighbors and who now he feels are his competitors, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, as examples.
And now we're talking about this and focused on this in the U.S. because there is a strong U.S.-Saudi Arabian relationship. What does that look like these days?
It's important to recognize that in May, it will mark the 90th anniversary of the United States recognizing formally the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So that longevity in many ways explains not only the relationship that Washington has with Riyadh, but also what the Biden administration has currently with the Saudi regime, both King Salman as well as with MBS. It's important to remember that the Saudis place a very high premium on continuity and on consistency when it comes to not just U.S. policy, but taking a look at its position within the broader geopolitical landscape. And as a result of it, I think Washington has recognized that, and with few exceptions, we find that it has really towed the line. It's, again, worth remembering that 15 out of the 19 hijackers in the 9/11 attacks were so the passport holders. And given the fact that the relationship has somehow withstood that trauma, it indicates that what has happened currently with the Khashoggi murder is being placed within that context.
What do you think of what we've seen from the Biden administration now in terms of response to the Khashoggi murders with the release of this information and now at least some action against some Saudi officials?
Nothing dealing with the Saudis or really with the region is without a tremendous level of nuance and a tremendous level of messaging. It's critical to recognize that President Biden spoke with King Salman, not with MBS, which is a drastic departure from the prior administration, which definitely dealt primarily, if not exclusively, with the Crown Prince. That is a very, very important signal because it recognizes that the king is still the king, and perhaps MBS has been a little bit over his skis, and still it's premature to anoint him as the formal king of Saudi Arabia. That time will come very soon. But for now, the fact that there has been this pivot, although it may not seem to be a very big deal, is in fact quite a rebuke to MBS. Secondly, the Biden administration's withdrawal of support for the Saudi military activities in Yemen is also seen as a rebuke to MBS. He is, among his various briefs in his portfolio, also the Minister of Defense of Saudi Arabia. And the Yemen campaign was very much seen as his project. The fact that the Biden administration has withdrawn support for it can only then be seen as also a bit of a slap in the face to MBS. So again, what we're seeing here is subtle digs, if you will, at MBS and a brief but still important recalibration of the relationship between Washington and Riyadh.
Talking to Saeed Khan, senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. He's talking to us about the Biden administration's response to the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the U.S.-Saudi Arabian relationship. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think a tougher, maybe less subtle punishment against the Saudi crown prince is needed? Do you worry about the effect it could have on the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia? Do you have questions for our guests about the politics of the region? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the Biden administration's actions against Saudi Arabia for the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Our guest is Saeed Khan, senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit. You can join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Whatever you want to bring up about the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, what you want to see the U.S. do, if anything more, in response to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi and this new report out on the intelligence about that. Let's go to your calls now. John is with us in Fitchburg. John, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to ask the guest what he thinks about the status of the freedom of the press situation in Saudi Arabia. Is it getting better?
John, thanks for the call. Saeed, freedom of the press in Saudi Arabia, any changes in recent years?
Not ones that we would necessarily be able to detect. And thank you for the call, John. The press in Saudi Arabia, as it is in many countries in the region, is highly regulated. It's also important to recognize that much of the media in the region follows a certain culture whereby the general criticism of the regimes is not one that we would necessarily see. Much of the coverage will be what we would regard as being rather ceremonial, rather orchestral, covering stories that have pageantry, meeting with dignitaries, foreign trips. So it's really not something that we would find much in common with the way that we negotiate with the press here. But again, you will not find much, if any, negative publicity regarding the leaders there.
Thanks for that call, John. And that that makes Jamal Khashoggi's murder stand out even more in some ways. Can you talk about his role as a journalist?
Well, Jamal Khashoggi was, of course, a very respected journalist and one who was able to leverage his distance geographically from Saudi Arabia in order to then describe and provide criticism of the regime, particularly those areas that he saw to be rife with contradiction and even hypocrisy. So the old axiom of the emperor having no clothes was something that Khashoggi was able to provide here as a reporter for the Washington Post. And that was something which was seen to be on multiple levels, highly problematic for a kingdom and for a regime that very, very judiciously and jealously guards its image, guards its reputation, and guards its credibility, because in many ways, that is what provides it with the legitimacy, not just from its own population, but as the dominant force in the so-called Gulf Cooperation Council, the group of Gulf states. Saudi Arabia really is the mothership. And as a result of it, anything that would seem to then cast a negative light on the kingdom, and particularly on its regime, is seen as the first step of a slippery slope that they do not want to take. And unfortunately, Khashoggi was then seen as an existential threat to MBS, even if not the regime itself. But MBS took it rather personally.
And then some people in the human rights community, in particular, Saeed, have said, in effect, we don't want subtle diplomatic signals. We want something directly punishing the Crown Prince for his involvement in this. From the perspective of the U.S. State Department, what kind of concerns would they have before doing much more than has already been done?
Well, again, it really goes to a 90-year-old relationship. And of course, also the kind of economic connections that exist with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It's not just the oil, it is the sovereign wealth fund. And at the same time, this comes at a very crucial period for the Biden administration in trying to assess what is America's positionality, not only in the Middle East, but really more geopolitically. It's no coincidence that the release of the report occurred at the same day as a conversation with King Salman, and then subsequently the Biden administration ordering military strikes on two positions within the Syrian-Iraqi border, ostensibly to neutralize or at least to attack positions that were seen as having a connection to Iran when it comes to Iran's sponsorship of various groups and insurgency elements in the region. And this, again, shows the kind of relationship that exists between the United States and the Saudis. It's a quid pro quo. It's providing something for something to allay the anxieties that the Saudis have that the Biden administration is looking to resurrect the joint comprehensive plan of action, also known as the Iran nuclear deal, and negotiations with Tehran. So as a result of it, and unfortunately, we see this happening quite a bit historically, not just with Saudi Arabia, human rights end up taking a backseat to what is known as realpolitik.
Time for one more quick call. We've got Bob on the line in Milwaukee. Bob, hi.
Hi, just to preface quickly, my daughter spent 2 years in Riyadh teaching in an international school. But here's the simplistic question. If Saudi Arabia did not have any oil, would we care what they do or don't do?
Thank you for the question, Bob. And the very succinct answer is no. But at the same time, it is oil, and we do care immensely about it, as we have for a very long time. As I said before, in 1931, the United States formally recognizes the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. In 1933, it signs its first oil deal by way of the Standard Oil Company of California. And that has in many ways defined, shaped not just the relationship so far, but well could well into the next century. It's important also to recognize that MBS is probably going to become king within the next 5 years at before the age of 40. It's expected that he'll probably serve for 40 years. That's 10 presidential elections. He certainly seems to have time on his side, and Washington recognizes that.
Thanks for that call. And Saeed, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit. He talked to us about the U.S. intelligence community's newly declassified report connecting the Saudi crown prince to the murder of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. In the fall, COVID cases began to spike in Wisconsin, especially among college students. UW-Madison student Azul Kotari lives on campus and had a front row seat to the wave of infections. This spring, the university is trying new tactics to try and prevent another surge.
My name is Azul Kotari. Right now I'm living as a house fellow in the dorms, so that's both my job and my housing, and I'm living in Celery Residence Hall right now. Do I feel safe? For the most part, I would say, at least lately and most of the time, I have felt fairly safe. In the beginning, there were a lot of kinks that really needed to be worked out. I mean, when we came back in for the fall, after having been on hiatus for several months, we were testing every 2 weeks, and I think it became really quickly apparent that that wasn't nearly enough. And there were definitely a lot of times last semester that I thought I would catch COVID, despite being pretty vigilant and my close friends being pretty vigilant about it. Just because there were a lot of people around me in my living situation catching it. So I just thought I would get it through community spread at some point. I thought it was pretty inevitable. I didn't end up getting it. Honestly, this semester, I think I'm not going to end up getting it either, just because the testing protocol has been a lot more vigilant and proactive. Testing twice a week is a lot, and making us all test to access community spaces at the school, like study rooms or lab space, makes me feel a lot safer, I think. You know, I'm sure there's a good reason for them switching to saliva-based testing as opposed to the nasal swab testing. Saliva testing is something that feels really weird to do. Basically, you enter this large room and they hand you a small vial and a funnel and tell you that you need to fill it up to a certain level with saliva. And you're not allowed to spit. You essentially have to pool drool underneath your tongue and have it flow out of your mouth into the funnel. And the reason everyone's talking about it is because it's literally the grossest thing. Everyone in the room is lined up, facing away from the center of the room, essentially urinal style, making weird movements with their jaw, trying to get their mouths to produce saliva and fill up this vial with saliva. And it's also a big nuisance because if you have anything to eat or drink beforehand, there's a good chance that your sample is going to get rejected. So imagine going through all that really awkward effort only to have your sample rejected and you losing building access the next day. So that's why a lot of folks are really frustrated with it. But I would say that the one biggest change for me is only being able to see my close friends outdoors at a safe distance. Whereas, like, earlier, a lot of our interactions would be centered around activities, you know, doing stuff. Most of the few things that you can still do that are COVID safe, like, you know, go on walks and stuff like that, are very centered around conversation. So there's a big change in the way you interact with people, I think.
WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites. You can hear more stories like this one at WPR.org/OutbreakWisconsin. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, Wisconsin held its first wolf hunt in years last month. A state wildlife expert joins the show for a look at the decision to allow that hunt and the impact it could have. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then under a bill in the state legislature, more people with criminal backgrounds would be eligible for having their records cleared. Our guests explain the problems they see with current expungement laws and how the new plan would help address Wisconsin's worker shortage. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.